Hello, hello. Welcome to the Cycling Central podcast for the week of the 26th of February, 2015. This is your weekly review of all things cycling. I'm Al Hines. This week on the show, the E3 Harelbeker is a little bit naughty and gets a reprimand from the UCI. Bert and Froome battle for top dog status in Spain. Thomas Dekker rides the owl but falls short even while on peyote. And are we unfair on mammals? That's all in this week's show, and with me is our regular trio of Philip Gomes, the managing editor of SBS Cycling Central, Anthony Tan, our, I guess, what do you call it?
I'm not the managing editor of SBS Cycling Central.
Editor at large in some ways, I'd got to call you. But
probably, something like that.
Unofficially, and yeah. And Ride Media's Rob Arnold. It's good to have everyone here. Good to see you guys.
Thanks for having us back,
Rob,
Al.
You look so depressed or something, the way you had your...
Actually, no, it was the thinker's pose. Actually, I've stopped thinking and I'll just talk now.
I think he looks incredibly tanned.
Yeah, I was about to say...
You only get tanned if you go in the sun, and I've only looked at my computer screen, I'm afraid.
Seriously?
To yeah.
All right. What about a
UV? Oh, monitor. You got a monitor tan.
Yeah. Maybe.
This is why Rob came in for a pep talk. Al said he looks depressed. Phil said he looks tanned, and I'll say you look insouciant.
Oh, well, thank you.
Beautiful.
But I just also need to point out that we're sitting very far apart in the studio today.
Yeah, we are. Everyone, no one is within arm's reach.
But we can hear each other.
Yeah. It's almost like we could have phoned each other in. It would have been like kind of like that.
Phil, I'll send you a text.
Huh? Yeah.
It could have been a four-way cross.
Do you reckon we could do a podcast in future by emoji? That could be interesting.
It's all the rage.
Explain.
Maybe we'll consider doing that. No, don't worry. Guys, let's quickly talk before we get into the podcast. I talk about the Harelbeker, not Het Nieuwsblad. Annemiek's 11th world title. That's pretty good, isn't it, Rob?
Isn't she unreal? She gets a bronze in team sprint, comes back a couple of days later, gets a silver in the 500 meter time trial in under 34 second time.
I don't think she went under 33.
But it was very, very fast. Back in the olden days, it would have been a world record, but she owns that as well. And then on the last day of competition, just to entertain us, she leads from the front for the entirety of the Kieran and smashes them. No one even looked like they were in with a bid.
And sadly,
to win the gold and to win the 11th world title.
And sadly, we should quickly give the conciliation to... the person that didn't get to compete in that race was Steph Morden with that bizarre rule enforcement, Tanny. But Mirzi, what more can you say?
Well, I noticed you said you can't say any more because she's beyond compare. I have to disagree with that. I think even saying someone is beyond compare is making a comparison. So,
interesting point.
Yeah. Well, you were getting into pedantic, so I would say, I think it's worth comparing. Perhaps, yeah, I think you have a legitimate argument to say, you can't really compare different riders across different eras, but I think it's worth comparing riders within the same era.
Yeah,
I think it puts someone on a pedestal.
But they weren't in the same era. And also, I think the problem is, I find with all this greatest, best sort of conversation, this is just what I get annoyed with.
It's marketing.
Okay, you're going to your blog.
Yeah.
Well,
just to fill everyone in.
Well, yeah, but Tanny brought it up. But I'm really talking about is more the additional adulation. It's almost like we always have to come to this sort of best ever. You know, I think it's quite easy to come to a best ever conclusion in a very cheap news piece.
If they didn't do it in cricket, what would they have to talk about?
Yeah.
No, that's a bit rich. But, I mean, everyone talks about who got the most runs in their life and all of that. So why wouldn't you talk about
it? It's not every day someone gets 11 world titles. So
Well, no, totally. And I think we should give absolute... And then that's what I said. I was trying to balance it. I didn't say that Mears is not deserving of recognition. I just was unimpressed by the amount of sort of trying to get... name everything as the best ever. You know, I it's not necessarily strictly about Mears. It's actually true of a lot of the media these days. You see, like, every fourth article, this is the best performance ever, you know, the best Olympic Games ever. It's just, I get sort of...
the best podcast you've ever heard.
Yeah, and that wasn't this week. That probably hasn't ever happened yet. But
I just want to sort of say sorry about last week. I got a bit ranted. I said that I wanted to throw chairs. It wasn't like that. I got a little bit overzealous.
And
I want to say congrats to the Australian Team Pursuit boys because they smashed it in their ride for the bronze. And if they hadn't caught the Germans, they wouldn't have ridden a at sub 354, and clearly they were on form to win a gold.
I'd like to thank them as well, because that little clip, that 6 seconds on Vine, we get well over 100,000 loops and something like 54,000 video views on Facebook. So thanks, fellas. You had a great world championship.
So they should do a dodgy bolt every now and again.
Phil is just such a stats man these days, man. You've changed, dude.
But it shows what people like about cycling. They like to see people falling over.
Well, there is that. But you know what it is? We were just talking about this off air, because Anna Meares obviously is a highlight of the world championships. But one of the things that struck me, and this is what I mentioned to Rob before we came on air, was that I'm watching the action and I'm seeing some fantastic racing. And yet the problem, a track continues to be a problem in terms of attracting mass audience when to me they have such a terrific value proposition. There's a lot of history. They're timed runs. I mean, I know that there are some events that, you know, might baffle some, you know, some drive-by viewers who may not understand. So like, you know, like the points race looks incredibly confusing to most people, even though we think it's fantastic.
Explain the rules of cricket to an American.
Yeah, well, that's
and
the thing, isn't it?
And suddenly the Madison and the points race looks completely
exactly,
easy.
Exactly, exactly. Mm. So I'm looking at this terrific racing and with so much drama, and there's so much drama, especially with around the Kiwis in the early part of the week. And I'm just continually baffled. The track just seems to incapable of cutting through.
I mean, it's very TV bites sort of entertainment. You know, all the events generally are over in 10, 15 minutes.
It is perfect cycling broadcast material, because it has something that cycling doesn't ordinarily have, which is an arena.
Yeah.
And you can do so much with that, capture so much drama.
But I think the biggest problem is, we touched on it a little bit, but stuff like what happened to Steph Morden, you know, all these sort of little rule infringement, overzealous official type things.
Yeah, but that adds to the drama, you see?
Yeah, but you've got a video referee and all every other sporting code. You've got a challenge in tennis. You've got to make it a little bit confusing.
I know.
Look at why the Kiwis were disqualified. That's the same sort of principle.
I know,
isn't it?
But I don't think people buy into that and go, well, that's good.
No,
that's
I defy.
It's confusing. It's dumb, but that happens in all sports.
That's right. I defy anyone to say that what happened to the Kiwis is not incredibly dramatic. They won that. Yes, we know. They won that, and they got done by a technicality. But then afterwards,
the victory lap.
But there was
the gold medal.
But it was the whole drama coming out of that, because if we have it isolated as a single video narrative on the website, and it's about 9 minutes long. So you've got the ride, and then you've got that event happening where they get get relegated. And then afterwards, it's even after on the podium, and then the French are there, and they're singing La Marseillaise, and the whole house is just in bedlam, right? Mm. And it's like, you can't, this is great for cycling.
That in itself doesn't turn people off. I'll agree with you on that. Where I'm against you all here, like the way I see track falling down is that there is competition, but it's not among many nations. Mm. For example, in road cycling, it's competition among many nations. It's like football, soccer, whatever you want to call it. You know, there you see a team who's ranked 20th can win beat a team ranked first on its day, and you don't see that in very rarely in track cycling, unless you get a wonder.
It allows that elite. Without that elite exclusion.
I find it elitist.
Yeah. But it doesn't mean that it's not compelling to watch. You look at the men's Kieran. That was a fantastic race. Yep. Actually, all of the racing was good.
It was great.
To see Brian Cockyard win, I don't even know the guy who we partnered up with the Madison, but this guy was destined to be a superstar in 2012 when he came out and won a medal in the Omnium in Melbourne. He went on and won a medal in the Omnium at the Olympics. He wins the Madison at home in fine style on Sunday, and the crowd went crazy.
All right, guys, we're going to not talk about track anymore, because we need to get through a lot of things. And I know Rob's just about to get passionate.
No, me too.
Just throw in a quick the recompense for the New Zealanders pursuit.
Rob, we're going to move.
They missed the team sprint, but to see the Kiwis win the team pursuit almost made me cry.
Okay,
Rob we'll Arnold.
And I've never been to New Zealand.
Rob Arnold is on probation from the rest of this podcast. Rob, watch yourself. I will cue Harry to take you off mic in future. Harry. Thank you very much. We're going to move on. Well, to quote Phil Gomes' classic line, Harold Becker, the bunch of organisers there are a bunch of arse clowns. It's a classic colloquialism of Phil Gomes. But Phil, Jacques Cousson, who's the spokesman of the race, said, "I've received a lot of responses, about 99% of which are positive. Here and there, there's a negative reaction, but there are only a few." He was responding, of course, to the fact that they did an ad, which was, I suppose, a parody of sorts of Peter Sagan and that incident from 2 years ago,
13,
I believe.
Yeah,
2013, when he pinched the podium girl's bottom. And that, at the time, was received very poorly, and it ended up with Peter Sagan issuing a apology, tail between his legs. The fact that Harald Becker have gone further and made an advertising campaign about this, I think, has bemused many, infuriated more, and has also earned the ire of the UCI. Phil, what were they thinking here?
Well, they weren't. Well, they probably were and thought they were being a bit clever about it all, but I think they were just being a little bit too clever. But it's time for the boys to grow up when it comes to cycling. That's the way I see it. And as far as that 99% is concerned, it would be 99% of middle-aged white males in a pub in Belgium.
There was no subtlety to it. When I first saw it, I thought, please don't retweet. Please don't retweet. Because it's just given the publicity to a poster that deserves no publicity.
Yeah. When I first saw it, I think I saw it on Daniel Lloyd, and then he retweeted, and there was a few little parodies already popping up. And I just assumed it was the actual thing was a joke. I just thought that there was no way that could actually have been the actual campaign poster. I thought, this is pretty funny. But then it turned out to be a freaking... I mean, Tony, you actually work in advertising. You work as a copywriter on occasion. What, you know, is there any strategic thinking that they could have, that you could rationalise something like this, or...?
Well, they were doing it because that race is overwhelmed by many other races, and this is a way, like Rob was saying, I mean, it's almost like I don't want to talk about it because it's just generating publicity for an event which doesn't deserve it. But yeah, I find it, there could have been so many other clever ways to generate publicity without going down this chauvinist angle. And yeah, they're doing it to create the exact furor which it has created. So in a way, the campaign has been a success.
But it's funny in some ways, because I think they could have still used that incident, but they could have spun it to make themselves not necessarily trolling everyone, and probably gained as much traction in the cycling media, being like, oh, it's good to see Harald Becker is lampooning that incident in a... a much more of a critical way.
Yeah, they could have been clever, saying there won't be any of this going on, yet they went turned around and said, who will be the next person to pinch a podium girl? So they could have reverse engineered it and been quite clever with it. Instead, they were just being dickheads.
I mean, what's bizarre about it is in 2013, it happened in the Tour of Flanders, not in Harald Becker, the incident with Sagan. Yep. So just to clarify.
But curiously, Sagan won Harald Becker in 2014.
Just serendipitously.
I'm just saying.
I guess what I'm thinking...
It's all linked.
I remember back how to ironic. that edition of the Tour of Flanders, and what was talked about for days, weeks, months afterwards was Peter Sagan's indiscretion. And what we should have been talking about, and I said it way back when, is that the race was outstanding and Cancellara's performance was wonderful. But it sort of... By the time the podium protocol was over, we stopped talking about cycling and we talked about stupidity.
For the next few weeks. The UCI made an official comment today, which was that they were extremely unhappy with the promotional poster of the E3 Harald Becker. We've reminded the organiser of its responsibility and the UCI regulations, and they've agreed to take off the poster from all communications platforms. It's an interesting sort of statement, the extremely unhappy, the little bit of a sort of a slap on the wrist. I never really get the sense that there's much forcefulness in the UCI. They were very late to the party with issuing this response. I think this is...
Surely the minute you see that Twitter with the World Tour logo there and UCI next to it, you call them up and say, pull it down.
Yeah.
You don't need to wait. Oh, let's just see if it creates a scam.
This is the problem with how bureaucratic the UCI is, though. I'm sure they... Actually, I'll give them some credit here. I think they were pissed off, especially when you've got a female as the vice president of our governing body. I mean, let's not forget that. I'm sure Tracy Gaudry was really peeved.
Yeah, and it's nearly a week.
To be man or a woman to be pissed off about it. No, I just think it just generally, it's just
yeah.
I think the problem is culture. The problem is that's right, Rob. You know, I think it perpetuates already what I think a lot of people perceive a stigma which is already present. Right. You know, and you've already got this problem with, you know, lack of female inclusion, certainly inequity in terms of the sports elite, probably even participation in audience, and then you do something like this. This is where the UCI does need to be very on the front foot and be like, no. We don't condone that at all. But the fact that it's nearly a week since this came out and the UCI's statement is pathetic.
Well, let's see. I guess the organisers will judge it and how they rate, I guess. Maybe. Because the broadcast is what they sell their that's what they make their money on, and sponsorship. If everyone boycotts the race, doesn't tune in, they might get a lesson.
But this is also easy.
So are people going to watch it or not watch it?
People are going to watch it, of course.
And I think that's separate in some ways. But this is it's also, I think, a funny thing about the way the World Tour, as much as it's a series, is still very much these unilateral organisers doing their own thing. I mean, you've got the ASO races, sure, but then you've got a collection of all different sorts of races which don't have any sort of concerted marketing campaign together. They don't have any brand. It's really just them working for themselves. Mm. And this is, I think, a problem that UCI probably needs to address. We've been probably talking about this for a long time in the pod, but you know, there's no overwhelming sense of a series when you've got these things sort of happening and happening quite commonly.
No, but we all know that the calendar is going to be reorganized as we go forward. And maybe Harold Becker, as a World Tour race this year, hasn't done themselves any favors in the future. Mm. See, that's the thing, right? So, you know, the race organizers need to think about this.
That's a good point, Phil, because this could really damage their chance of being on that.
Yeah, and I don't think.
And if it doesn't, then who's paying attention?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and maybe. Sorry. No, Phil. Were you? I mean, it's 100% true. I mean, they're essentially a borderline World Tour race as is. You'd have to say. I mean,
no one knew Harold Becker before. I mean, it was a semi-classic at the best of times. Yes,
It was HC classification.
But now everyone knows the name.
Yeah. Mm. Anyway,
the reality is, it's not gonna. You know, if you're gonna drop a race from the UCI calendar because you wanna have a more organized World Tour calendar. Well, let's face it. You know, Harold Becker's sitting on a hot seat. Exactly, you know, they're going to get voted off the island before anyone. So, you know.
And on that Survivor reference, we will move on to talk about the Vuelta a Andalucía. Well, last week, Chris Froome took overall victory in Spain at Andalucía. But that was only after Contador took a solo victory ahead of Froome on the snow-covered peak of Hazalianas in the Sierra Nevada. Froome then got revenge the following day on the Alto de Allanadas.
God, and double L's.
Just on a climb.
And sealed the overall win. It's
5 points for effort.
Sealed the overall win the following day. For me, the thing about Andalucía is this is the first real skirmish we've had between these two guys, and this is continuing what was all through last season. It was every little bit of, you know, dancing between the two, Dauphiné, Torino. Obviously this season will be a bit different because of the Giro, which Contador will be going to and Froome won't, but it's so good to see these guys back at it and going, really, trading blows in a almost equal manner this early in the season.
Yeah, I mean, this is what you want, Al. I mean, it's setting the scene beautifully. It's, like you said, it's quite consistent with last season because let's also remember Vincenzo Nibali is just kind of...
Who's that?
Doing...
Oh, yeah, the Tour winner. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. He might come back in July and pump them all again. Then we've got Quintana. He's eschewing the Giro this year to concentrate on the Tour. So to have four, you know, what they call the Fab Four, all doing their own thing. But, yeah, with respect to Froome and Contador, they're actually almost following a very similar trajectory leading to the Tour. Like, the next race will be Catalunya, I think. They're both doing that. So it's very much psychological, as much psychological as physical.
Are they not doing Torino? Sure, they'll be doing Torino, right?
Together. I'm not sure, but I just know that they're on a, you know, following a fairly similar program, and it seems to me that they're trying to edge each other out before the tour's even started.
Tony, you wrote a blog about Tinkoff emulating Sky a little bit in the way they were riding in Andalusia, which was a good observation, and maybe one that they're trying to sort of looking at successful formula and going, well, this has worked for them. I suppose they've been kind of developing this for a little while with the riders that they've brought on, and this is maybe finally crystallizing now with races like Andalusia. But Sky also were very impressive in their own way. You've got two super teams really looking like super teams.
Yeah, I think I was perhaps not premature in my observation, but I thought that a Cycling Central reader made a really good point under the blog saying that Sky, they are riding as they were before, but now they're experimenting a little bit on that final climb where you had Kenyak and another guy go off. And
Nieve.
And you're thinking, why are they doing that? They're trying to make the others chase, obviously, but they're trying to develop another, quiver, you know, a bow in their quiver, you know, in their arsenal of little things that they can do, because I don't think they can rely on science only, and they're realizing that, and they're just, these are the races which you want to experiment in, though.
Add something else to the playbook.
Imagine on a similar topic, but just to go off on a tangent, they've got a team in Oman, Sky, they've got, and many other teams, Oman. They win the title and a stage with Geraint Thomas in the Volta Algarve in Portugal.
Yep.
Across the border in Ruta del Sol, they're going head-to-head with a Tour de France contender. It just the logistics of that one team alone is immense. And they sort of they didn't have a great Oman, but it's quite amazing to see that they can spread themselves so well.
No, I mean, this is I mean, that's a good point.
All teams, not just Sky.
And what are they trying to do, do you think, Rob? Are they trying to create competition, like, perhaps within the team for that? Those two, they just want them to be so hungry by the time it comes to the tour, because if they...
No, but there's all different initiatives, aren't there? Mm. I mean, Geraint Thomas has missed out on the classics, where he really could have had good classics in the past. But last year, if you looked at from Milan-San Remo all the way through, it's every race that he did in the classics, he crashed. You know, so at least we just sort of... I hope that Geraint, who
that,
won
that
the
will
stage,
limit your results, crashing.
It sort of doesn't really add to the potential of winning.
Yeah, Phil... Just on the Sky thing, I mean, this is a return really to sort of what they were doing in 2013, where they were going to stage races and just dominating. Because as Rob pointed out, they did win Algarve as well with Thomas, but not just that. Richie Porte won the Queen's stage. He was up right in the top 10. Yep. I think at Ruta del Sol.
He was fourth.
So he was fourth right up there. Mm. At Ruta del Sol, Nieve was in the top 10. Peter Kenyak was in the top 10. And I think David Lopez was in the top 10. So they're not just turning up and winning. They're also dominating these races.
Yeah. I really want to speak to just a couple of two guys in particular, right? So it's great that these two teams are performing this early, and it's good to see this kind of action happening because it brings interest into these early season races. But obviously, certain other contenders are really looking to time their run a little bit more finely. And Nibali is one of those guys. And he's looking like he did last year, which was, remember the infamous Vino letter, which is basically, you know, if you guys don't get your act together, I'm going to start beating you daily. So, and then Nibali shows up at the tour, and obviously he's perfectly fit for the Tour de France. So I think that's a situation there where, you know, all of this discussions about Sky and Saxo and Contador and Froome, but then you've got Nibbles just kind of sitting there just very also quietly. The other guy that was interesting to me was TJ Van Garderen. Now, you know, we recognize that this year's Tour de France is not necessarily going to be in his best interest, the way the parcours is designed. But the way he looks so skinny at Oman. He looks seriously fit and ready to race at Oman. Of course, he ends up finishing second, but for that one day that didn't work out because the race got blown off the course. You know, he could have won that race as well, and then we'd be speaking a little bit. We'd be adding his name to the mix.
Mm. Are we going to put in Rafael Valsferri, the winner of Oman, into that mix?
Please.
We have a little. I remember he's an interesting character, and he looks incredibly fit
good.
As well.
And he said that as well. Yeah.
This is the indication of how the season is changing. The impact of, for one of a, it's stretching a long bow, but the impact of the Tour Down Under is immense because the racing is no longer that these ones that we're watching currently are training races. Yeah, it's full gas already, full gas. And if Richie turns up in January weighing 60 kilograms and Froome looks like he does and Contador's racing like he is and you know, like you say, TJ, everyone else, but everyone is turning up race ready.
And the thing about Van Garderen specifically was he was actually, a bit peeved that he didn't win that race. I mean, he wanted to win that race.
Yeah, and I think he was quite disappointed that stage got cancelled. It is interesting though, Phil, as you raise. I mean, you know, we can talk about how guys are going well this early in the season, but I want to go back to that Nibali point. Yeah. Last year, I remember at Oman, he finished 24th, 25th, and there was concerns, you know, he's not up to the form that he is. I mean, this is a guy that has gone to Grand Tours the last 5 years, and I think he's the most consistent finisher out of all these guys, out of Contador, out of Froome, out of Quintana. He doesn't miss a beat. And, you know, in some ways, it's one of those things where you do better early in the season. Well, good on you, but... I mean, my goals are in July. My goals are in May. And
we've got a piece on Nibali in the next issue of my magazine, due out a little bit later than I'd anticipated, but we won't go there. And it explains there's logic behind it. He's got a trainer, and they offered the example of that Dauphiné stage last year where Contador and Froome were going toe-to-toe, and Nibali was there, and then he wasn't, and he switched off. And his trainer, refers to the fact that they were riding to numbers, as simple as that. Once Nibali realised that they were pushing at numbers that he didn't want to be at in June, he just pulled the pin. So he was exactly racing only for July. Mm-hmm. And so the results in the early season for Nibali don't count. And it looks like that's happening again, and we'll see what sort of master stroke he can pull out come May.
And of course, it's in his best interest that Froome and Contador race against each other early and test each other and push each other this way. And, you know, he can just sit back and just kind of go, hey, you know,
look what happened
tranquilo.
To them at the Tour, They race so hard against one another. I mean, Froome didn't crash because he was racing Contador on the cobbles, but they were just so nervous and so protected and so, et cetera, that Nibali just... rode on through.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
To the other side.
Guys, just a reminder, the next race in the season that we will be covering live will be Paris-Nice, so that'll be a good test. I think Richie Porte, Bradley Wiggins will both be riding, as well as a few of the Anglo-Americans. I think TJ's riding, as is Talansky. So should be a little hit out, bit of... 2013 Paris-Nice mixed in there, maybe Talansky.
Matthews is going.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of him too. He's good. Yeah.
And I'll just put it out there. It's a long way away, but he's going to win Milan-San Remo.
Well, we'll see about that. Anyway.
Oh, my goodness.
Right,
guys, move on.
All right, that's good. We're going to leave that there. Let's move on. Well, Thomas Dekker, the Dutchman who has basically put a big ad on his shoulders or ad somewhere. He put an ad. He was wanted to do an ad. He went did an hour record, which is the way you do ads these days if you want to get a new contract. And he went to Mexico, which, I mean, that's far away from all the European teams, so not ideal in some ways. But he did and was at altitude, tried to do an hour record. And
is that in Mexico? Is it
Agua
Calientes? I thought that was in Peru because that's where you get off the train to go to Machu Picchu.
There is Agua Calientes, the warm waters.
Yeah. Okay. This is another Agua Calientes.
Aguas Calientes.
Aguas, as opposed to Agua Caliente. Okay. This has got an S in it. So, proceed.
Yeah. Anyway.
1,800 meters above. Sea level.
Yeah. 52.221 kilometres was what Dekker rode, which is just shy, but just a lap, basically, short of what Rowan Dennis did. So he'd be pretty peeved that he got that close. But
yeah, and Phil's looks very upset.
He's beaming. But Phil, we've talked about this a little bit, well, actually a lot, outside of the podcast, but your feelings are that someone who is... riding at altitude, who has perhaps a checkered past, you didn't want him to be necessarily the guy that would be setting a record at altitude because of what it might represent. is my understanding of your point.
Well, no, my point specifically is, you know, Decker.
You don't like Thomas Decker.
No. No, I'm sure he's a lovely
fella. That's a very specific point.
Yes, and I'm sure he's a lovely fella, and he's great to hang out and have beers with, and his time was great, but I would love to have known what he would have ridden at sea level at a velodrome in Switzerland. But be that as it may, it was an interesting event because we got to see the first hour record done at altitude, and as such, it was a good moonshot on his part. So, you know, it gives
in the modern era.
In the modern era. Sorry, you know, since the UCI just recently changed the some of the equipment rules, et cetera, for the hour record. So he's the first under the new regime, and I think some of the future guys who may come through will be looking at that pretty closely and trying to gauge what his numbers were and to see whether maybe they should give it a shot at altitude as well. I think Bradley Wiggins might have a rethink on...
No, he'll do London.
He'll do London? You're pretty sure?
For sure.
Yeah.
Be rad. Big
monster.
Big atmosphere.
Yeah, huge. Wow.
It'd be cool. But just, I think, I watched Decker's ride this morning.
Yeah, sorry.
And he did make Rowan Dennis look very good. And it was funny, last night before I left the office, I did a little survey on my social media just to try and get people to come in with a prediction for the number, the distance that they thought that Decker might go. And Robbie McEwen chimed in and added 49.3. And then he quickly corrected himself this morning and said, well, he did a lot better than I expected. And I retorted to him in a discussion saying that... I'm surprised he went as far as he did because he looked as rough as guts on the bike. And he responded saying, given how bad he looks on the bike and how he always is a masher, he did an incredible time and held a position pretty well. But he was all over the track.
But the implication potentially being that if he can do that and he can do a time which is almost the record, what can someone like... Yeah, Wio or Fabian or Tony Martin do at that altitude.
Or even
he held
Dennis.
His actual physical position well. Like he didn't get out of the tuck much, but he did drift up above that red line a number of times. Yeah, a couple of times I thought he was swinging up to let the second wheel come through.
He probably did 250 extra meters just by drifting off the line.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what the extra was. Yeah,
But
maybe it's symbolic, Al, that. You know, he's constantly drifting off the line.
Read into that what you will.
I think I
enjoyed this tweet from... there was a bit of a tweet exchange between Scott McGorry, one of our executive producer, Stuart Randall, on Twitter. And Scott was talking about... basically they were arguing about whether altitude should be recognised the same way. An altitude attempt should be recognised the same way as a non-altitude attempt. And... there's a feeling among a lot of us that would give you an advantage, but equally, as Scott pointed out, well, as long as the UCI is ratifying it, it's being ratified, and there are other things.
The advantage is that the air is thinner, and the disadvantage is that the air is thinner.
And there's, as Scott pointed out as well, I think, which is a reasonable point. You know, if barometric pressure isn't being regulated, if the boards or the type of road, you know, all that sort of stuff is going to have an effect on performance. At the moment, we're not saying that the hour record needs to be run in Grench in Switzerland or not. And I think that without that sort of consistency, you can't try to claim any sort of hypocrisy in other people's records because it's an open field.
Yeah, and all velodromes have their nuances, right?
Exactly.
So,
And I think you had a... There was an you did an interview with Anna Mears,
right?
After she talked about the track and the nature of the track and the banking, and how important that was for an endurance discipline versus a sprint discipline.
Yep.
So that was pretty interesting technical information.
I republished that online yesterday because of the Decker's attempt on that track because she referenced a couple of things about how they controlled the environment with it's a tent like building and without the. The doors shut, the roof will actually sag in and fall in on itself. Little things like that. So they're controlling the environment. But she also explained about the timber, the nature of the timber, how there was a...
Like grooves.
Yeah, like grooves. Hmm. And just different shapes, different ways. I mean, if you go back to the a couple of weekends ago where I can't remember his name, excuse me, but a guy who is a full-time... worker, he tried an hour record and he did a 48 kilometer or maybe 49. It was an incredible effort for someone who rides 12 or 14 hours a week. And he was saying how he underestimated the effect of the G-forces on the bend on his crutch. And when I spoke with Rowan Dennis after his hour, he said the worst thing that he had was the absolute pain on his undercarriage because he was riding a constant 105 RPM for an hour and being thumped into the saddle on the bends. And there's so many different things to consider about track cycling, and so it's beautiful.
You mean
that should be more popular, and everyone should ride a fixed gear.
Do an hour record and maybe see infertility increase. Is that...
No, I don't know. I don't know. If you
well, we guys had kids, Rowan hasn't, so that'll be the, I suppose, the big test. Although, I mean, you can't really compare Wigo then because he's not going to have any more kids, unless he does have kids. Do you reckon he would have had a vasectomy, Wigo?
No.
Yeah, I guess. No. That's...
Well,
now,
talking about track shape, and suddenly we're talking about little soldiers.
That's right. While we're, you know, now that we're still on this discussion about the hour record, up until this point, we haven't seen a woman make an attempt for the hour
record.
Sarah
Story will be making hers very soon.
That's right. And she will be hoping to break Leontien Varmusel's record. I think it was 40. What was that time you said? Is it Dutch
I don't remember. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Anyway, she'll be the first one under this new regime by the UCI who will attempt to set a new women's time. And that in itself will be very interesting to watch because she does have a terrific track pedigree as well.
And I think it will. Hopefully that could also give a momentum behind the women's cycling aspect of it all. Because if we can encourage, you know, some Australian, you know, someone like Shara Gillow could be a good contender potentially, or I'm not sure. I mean, we need to look out for... So we can, you know, encourage someone, I don't know, Annette Edmondson, I don't know, you know, someone who could...
Are you that interest? I thought you were on the same page as me about the hour record the elitism of the track.
I don't
get excited about it.
Okay, thanks. Tanny, thanks, Tanny.
I spoke with a guy who has the record for Australian in the 35 to 40 bracket. He did the hour. Jason Austin is his name.
There was a record
and,
for that.
And he did it a couple of years ago. He's done it the hour a few times, and he was telling me about how on his last attempt, he was going fine, and then suddenly had a lights out moment where he was just literally drifting right up the top of the track. He just basically couldn't see for a couple of laps. He was just really cross-eyed and was in a right royal bad state. And to be continued. I'll follow up with him and we'll find out some more thoughts because I know that he's been attracted to another crack at it. And I just think there's a lot of people who can find it as a tangible challenge.
Although I did enjoy Dan Lloyd's tweet. I keep mentioning Dan Lloyd. I don't like him that much, but he's a funny guy, you know, ultimately. Anyway, he made a comment.
Ultimately. Anyway, go on.
He made a comment about comparing Dan. Rowan Dennis and Thomas Dekker's hour records. He said... Thomas Dekker is now 5 minutes into his hour record. At 5 minutes into Rowan Dennis's record, they were at the same amount. They were both 5 minutes in. I thought that was quite a humorous comment because it was, you know, they're both.
Because it was like time?
Yeah, because it was time. Yeah, anyway.
That's like a serious dad joke.
Yeah, good. And he is. Like, that's. Yeah. I appreciate that sort of humor.
He's straight out. He's like that Phil dude in Modern Family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, I mean, he's very successful. That's a very successful show. Exactly.
And you're stopping Matt Keenan.
Matt Keenan's like that. Matt Keenan puts in all those kind of dad jokes.
All right, guys, quickly, finally, I want to move on to one final discussion, very important discussion, which we need to have, and it is in response to last week. Well, don't hate on the mammals. That was the message we got from an interested listener who described himself as a mammal, and he wrote an email to myself and he said that he was concerned about the way we speak about mammals but also broadly how the media treats mammals. And in that sense, he was speaking to, you know, the idea that I guess there's a bit of derision towards people who are taking up cycling towards their middle ages, and you know, and I can see what he means. You know, there's a degree of intimidation for those people entering. There's not a degree of acceptance. You know, a lot of people have been cycling their entire lives, and mammals are sort of this new culture. But
rag on mammals? I don't remember doing that.
I wrote a blog on mammals a while ago, but I don't think I really got stuck into it. It was more that perhaps that if their inclusion precluded other groups, then I had an issue. Yeah, but otherwise, I don't care.
I think that there's also two clarifications which probably need to be made as well. One is that I'll just read out what he wrote. I love being out of the city and on my bike. I do all of this by myself. My circle of friends are all from my former sporting obsession. None ride, but I would really like to ride with others. Because of the way you guys talk and write about mammals and recreational cyclists, I feel like I can't approach a cycling club or group ride because they would treat me the same way I feel newbies and mammals are belittled in the media. I think there's probably a bit of confusion about what he's saying.
Is that because you jumbled up the words like you did last week? Remember that reader comment last week?
I think
Bradley Wiggins. I don't know, but I want to say one thing. One is that I think there's two groups of mammals. One is this very elite sort of group, which is
the racing mammal.
Yeah, the racing mammal who takes it up, takes it very seriously, does the Masters Ironman and rides criteriums and shaved legs and all the gear and caboodle and spends $15,000 a year on their bikes. And I think we did talk about them a little bit in our last podcast. I think there's also the group of mammals who are
recreational mammals.
Very recreational. And they take it up more to just get fit. And I can definitely see the intimidation factor between those, the difference in intimidation between those two groups.
But from one comes the other. You know, like I always equate cycling to surfing. Well, I grew up in Coffs Harbour, and when I got back from Holland when I was a teenager, I wanted to do surfing. But by then, the horse had bolted, and I didn't really understand it. I walked into a surf shop, and I felt totally intimidated. I didn't know to ask for a thruster or, you know, or a dual fin or whatever. Like, I had the terminology all wrong, and they all looked at me like I was an idiot. So I did boogie boarding. And and anyway, that's a long, sorry, bad tangent. But
do
the
they
point
call it
is,
bodyboarding
I think
these
that
days?
People need to just realize that if it's going to be intimidating a little bit at first, but just, you know, just enjoy that. Just try and learn the lesson. Go into a bike shop, listen to the lingo that they speak, buy my magazine, have a read of how we talk about cycling. You know, we don't want to be preclusive. Is that the word? To be
exclusionary.
Not, yeah. We want everyone to be part of what we do because it's great. Mm. And when you go into something for the first time, it's going to feel a little bit isolating and a bit strange and a bit...
I mean, what makes something special in some ways is that
but
unique
that's,
culture,
that
right?
Adds to the adrenaline, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Tanny?
Ooh,
yeah.
I'm nervous about turning up. Ooh, but when I'm there, I feel thrilled.
Yeah,
I mean, if there were no barriers to entry, there would be no such thing as a club, would there not?
Although, to be fair...
I'm not saying clubs are good in their exclusionary stance or ethos, but I'm just saying there's always a barrier, whether it's a cycling club or a bikey club. Not that I condone joining a bikey club.
Well, it's illegal.
Yes.
In some,
is it?
Oh, in Queensland. But
moving right on.
Neither here nor there. but one thing I do think is, like, there is a certain degree of elitism in some of the racing culture. Like, I mean, if you're getting involved in the club for the first time and maybe, you know, you don't shave your legs, you wear mismatching kit, all of this sort of stuff, or you have a bad bike, you have all this sort of stuff.
Then we're getting really getting into the nuances of the racing mammal, though, because there's so many different tiers. And if you're just joining a club, I mean, particularly, I don't know, Randwick Botany or whoever, they're very accepting.
Yeah, but I think it can, I definitely think it can vary club to club, and there is a degree of that exclusive aspect perhaps overplayed in some clubs, which, I mean, they, I suppose,
well,
they
yeah, okay, that. If you're going to join the Rafa club, what do you expect? If you don't turn up in a $400 pair of Knicks, you're going to get thrown out the back door.
Gamesy, you're probably
no,
one of the...
No, I think you can turn up in your kit, any kit. You can turn up in, if...
What about not in even in Lycra?
Don't shave your legs. Just turn up. Just and if you walk all over them and take their Strava KOM, then they're going to be pretty annoyed. No, Phil, I don't know. But it's
final thought
it's for
from
everyone,
Phil.
And everyone should do it. Well, not Phil. You know, you ride, I ride. You ride, Al.
I don't. Yeah,
Anthony,
I ride.
The rumor has it. Yeah. You know, we all. That, why? Because it's fun.
It's fun. Yeah.
Unless you're riding against Tiff.
But this.
Then she just beats you up.
That's right. Ah, oh, look, man, I don't know what to think. It's just, actually, I do know what to think.
Yeah.
Right, I usually do. Look, I get where he's coming from, and this has always been an issue with cycling. I remember when I first got into road cycling in Hamilton in Canada, got into road cycling in a serious way. Effectively, a lot of the old dudes were at this club, and these were in the days of toe clips. We were just transitioning to to clipless pedals, and I show up and I've got brand new Cannondale aluminium cad with clipless pedals when they just come out, and all the guys around me were still on steel with toe clips, and I was the local freak. Now, you know, I wasn't really allowed to do much in the way of turns, etc., in that club at the start. I mean, in fact, people hardly talked to me because I looked like a freak. Mm. You know, the clothes I was wearing, etc., these guys were really old school. And this has always been an element of cycling, is that initial period. And then it was like after 3 months, and then, you know, then the ice started to break, and, you know, I was able to pull my turns. And, you know, this is what happens.
The wheels of change grind slowly, yeah, or whatever.
You know,
or
look, you know what? You know, part of me doesn't mind that, and I'll tell you why. Because I got an education. I got an education from those guys on how to ride a bike and how to ride a bike in a bunch. Mm. And I think part of the problem with some of the newcomers to cycling is that they don't have
a proper initiation.
And I know many clubs make a big effort these days to try and introduce people in a paced way into riding in bunches, and it's a lot more inclusive in that sense than when I first started. Mm. But at the same time, there are quite a few people who don't like taking instruction, and they just think because they show up with a $10,000 bike and brand new gear that it should be in the front of the bunch, and I'm thinking, get off the front.
But yeah, there's ways to give instruction and ways to take instruction, aren't there?
Yes, like,
and true. If you accept that you're not being put down, you're just being recommended a better... I don't know.
Alternative.
Yeah.
All right, that's it.
I've been told to be quiet.
That's it. That's it. No more. And Rob has been. He doesn't usually listen to me, though. That's a change. That's good. A good change. Positive change.
Should we talk about Simon Gerrand?
Thanks
and
for
the silver medal.
Thanks for joining us, everyone. Don't forget, for all your news, blogs, videos, and more, we're always creating more content online. You can find this podcast on soundcloud.com/cyclingcentral, and you can find the RSS feed, which you can throw into your iTunes. We are broadcasting Paranese. A quick reminder, that's in a bit over a week's time. And for everything else, well, you know, there's always next week. Thanks again, and see you then.